All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fuck nicks? What's going on? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Welcome to it. I'm back here. I'm in Los Angeles, back at my home, hanging out for a little nice chunk of time, getting re-grounded, hanging around the house, sitting on the porch, talking to the cats, cleaning shit up, getting a little work done around the homestead. Helpful. Today I talked to Paul W. Downs. He is one of the co-creators, writers, and stars of Hacks. He plays the manager guy. He's very funny. He's nominated for Emmys for this year for both writing on the show and as a supporting actor. It's weird because I should have talked to him a while ago. It was interesting because he was the first person ever pitched to us from the show, from Hacks. But we thought it would be a little weird to have this female-led show written and co-created by women. And the first person we had on from it would be the one guy involved in the development. So we've since had Jen Statsky on and Hannah Einbinder on. So now it was Paul's turn. And I didn't really know this guy, but he seems like a funny guy. I love the show. It's an astounding accomplishment in comedy writing. It really is. It's really great. And as a comic, watching a show about comics, hard to get that right. And I know it's tricky to have somebody acting the part of a stand-up, but she does it. Jean does it great. And, you know, there's always going to be a little something that's, you know, a stand-up comic has that comicness that is, you know, ingrained in their soul. And I know that. But in terms of, like, getting the life right and her getting the character right, and he's funny. It's a great show. I'm 100% on board with that show. And I didn't know he had a past in stand-up. I had no idea where he came up through and how in terms of the comedy world. So that was a fun conversation. It was a good time. Like the guy. Good guy. Funny guy. You can hear it in a few minutes. I'll be in Tucson, Arizona at the Rialto Theater on Friday, September 20th. Then I'm in Phoenix at the Orpheum Theater on Saturday, September 21st. You can go to WTFpod.com/tour for tickets and get the dates for the shows that were rescheduled in 2025. So my ego up in Vancouver is contracted into something Canadian, I think, just because I have that weird innately codependent symbiotic connection that just happens without any awareness of mine until I'm in it with any culture, place, person. It just happens. But, you know, feeling that small and feeling like, you know, just me is not great. It turns out like I'm plagued with anxiety. I'm constantly future tripping. I'm worried about bullshit. If I have any free time in my head, I'll fill it with worry about things that don't even exist. It's almost like a hobby. And I don't think I can do anything. I don't think I can do anything. And that's just one step away from I think I suck at everything. There's the idea that sort of like no matter what I've been doing my whole life, somehow or another, it's been a couple of weeks, I can't do it anymore. And then the next step of that is, I know I've done all these things in my life, but it turns out now that I haven't done them for 3 weeks, I fucking suck at everything. Yeah, isn't that great? Such progress on a core level that I've made. But generally, I wouldn't call it a better angel, but my grown-up self is sort of like, dude, just, it's fine. You'll be fine. Well, what do you think's going to happen? But I hadn't done comedy in what felt like weeks. And I get on and, you know, I put in at the store because I want to cram it in, do the fucking work, figure out where I'm at up there. Like it's going to change. Like I don't know who I am. And I go to the store and just driving into the place. And I know I've waxed romantic about that place and about my past there. But it's been a long time since I kind of rode out the whole night, you know. But, you know, I get there and there's just, you know, people around, you know, all the folks. And all of a sudden this bearded man comes up to me. Like he looks like a prophet coming down from the mountains. And it's old Ron White. Hadn't seen Ron in a long time. Certainly not since he's all gray and bearded and long haired and sober. Fucking Ron White, one of the greats, was just in the hallway. And I was like, holy fuck, Ron, you know, I give him a hug and I hadn't seen him in a while. I was excited to watch him and who else was around. You know, Burr was running out and I said, how's it going? He goes, yeah, fine. Yeah. And then he storms out and I'm like, of course, I'm assuming, hey, he's got to be mad at me, right? Why'd you just do it? Like, what's he running away from me for? What's going on? I follow him and I'm like, what's going on? He's like, nothing. I got to, you know, go. Had nothing to do with me. And then I remembered, oh, if Burr was mad at me, that is definitely a moment that he would take the time to tell me. he's not a guy who's going to fuck that guy. And he'd be like, what the fuck is, what was that shit? You know, so, you know, a little drama in my head. And, but like I hung around and then just got later in the night. And it's an interesting thing about the store is like what the store is on any given night from 8 o'clock till about 10:30. You know, after that, it changes. And I'm usually gone by then. And I'm sure I've talked about this before, but like a lot of the audience leaves and it's a little scattered. And Blair Saki is there, who I just interviewed. And she's got to go on after Ian Bagg. And he's a guy who I've known probably for fucking 30 years. And then it was pretty amazing. It must have been like midnight. And Sam J goes on. And it's like, you know, the audience is you know, it's small, but, you know, and it's scattered, but they're around. But she was just doing the thing, man. You know, I've interviewed her. I don't know her that well. You know, she's a little intimidating to me. But she was up there working shit out in a very honest but raw as fuck way, you know, with big ideas and big honesty about her being tired of being a lesbian. And some like gritty fucking funny ass details. But like there was a vibe to that kind of honesty where you're really kind of stepping out on the ice and you're showing a part of yourself in a kind of mildly, you know, angry, fed up, but unique way in terms of, you know, what she's thinking about. And I just hadn't seen that kind of work. It reminded me of Patrice O'Neill, who I know, you know, she's a fan of. And it just, it was great to see, you know, that raw shit happening in a world of garbage, in a world of false risk-taking, of fake edgelords, of boring crowd work, of, you know, kind of tired or detached joke-telling, just to see somebody get down there and wrestle with the filth of being a person in that person's body and then kind of broadening that out, you know, into the world at large and just reflecting in the moment about her, you know, feelings about Kamala and about, you know, black culture. And it was just like, I don't know, there was an honesty to it that creates a kind of electricity in the room, even though it was late and there weren't that many people there. Just, I was so fucking thrilled to see that work being done. And I'm just glad I hung out late. And then Steve Fury goes on, he kills, he's fucking funny. Just to watch, it was Tuesday night, you know, and to watch, you know, like late night fucking, you know, comics up there doing the work for a tired fucking crowd that's half the size it was or a quarter the size it was. And just, you know, kind of doing the real shit, you know, fucking reaching in to get the laughs, but also just, you know, there's a purity to it, an authentic, you can't hide up there when, you know, you've got to go do the gig, do the job for a tired bunch, a small group of people, but also you want to be funny, but also, you know, there's a, once you get through at that size of crowd, there's a freedom to it. It was great, man. It was great. And it felt good to be there. But then I go home and I can't sleep. There's just moments where I wish I knew how to get out of myself in a way that's enjoyable for, I don't know. It's all about the comedy. It's all about talking to people. It's all about the dynamics in the relationship. It's all about, you know, the cats. But boy, my brain finds time, man. It's a whole other parallel universe of my mind versus the reality around me. But I guess that's life. I don't like that I have this fucking time to spin this shit around. I mean, when does that stop? Truth is, I guess never. But I did enjoy the DNC. Man, Michelle Obama kicked ass. Barack kicked out. It's very exciting just to see the, you know, kind of weird, vulnerable, joyful excitement of a big, broad, diverse audience of people finally feeling represented in a way that they could get excited about and re-engage their vision of just fucking basic decency. Enough of these fucking assholes. Just doubling down on fucking abusive garbage. Just basic fucking decency. And it's just thrilling that now that there's a bunch of grown-ups in the room that know how to speak about things eloquently and in a way that is uplifting and proactive, just makes the fucking other side look like a bunch of limited fucking clowns without even starting shit. It's just, we were just missing that dialogue. It's, again, I don't know what's going to happen. I wouldn't say I'm optimistic, but just seeing excited people trying to get back to a time where people were just basically fucking decent, compassionate fucking individuals in communities and whatnot. Not just fucking angry, traumatized, unprocessed bile and grievance and entitlement and abusiveness. Just fucking relax. Be a fucking person. Can we all just be fucking people who care about people? Christ. So that was what I got out of it. I don't know what you got out of it. All right, look. Paul W. Downs is, again, very funny. He's nominated for Outstanding Supporting Actor in a Comedy Series and Outstanding Writing for a Comedy Series at this year's Emmy Awards for Hacks. And this is the first time I really talked to him or met him, I think. Yeah. Okay. Here we go. Where are we, three seasons in now?
Yeah, the third season ended.
Yeah, I watched it. I watched them all.
Thank you for watching.
Appreciate yeah, it. I don't do that often.
I get it. I've seen two episodes of everything. So I don't finish everything myself, but.
Well, I think I had a lot invested in it because, you know, there's some part of me as like a lifer comic.
Yeah.
Where you're like, oh, they're going to fuck it up.
All right, well, yeah. I mean, have we?
No.
Okay, good.
It's a hard thing to do. I mean, there's like, I don't know how you quite pulled it off. But the life of a veteran comic who has a draw, who has a Vegas residency, is very specific.
Yeah.
So that was sort of a smart place to start, because that life is not the normal comic life.
Right. It's not somebody in L.A. or living in New
York. Or on the road.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, it's alluded to that she was that.
Yep.
At some point, and then does it again.
Yep.
So, like, I just thought the sort of, you know, getting the life right seemed pretty good, because I don't know that life. And I knew comics, like this comic, her character reminds me a lot of Brett mm-hmm. Butler.
Sure, yeah.
Who I knew.
Yeah.
I wish I was in touch with Brett, but it's very random.
Yeah.
But I just knew the life, but I don't know how the hell you got it right. How did you?
I don't know. I mean, you know, she is an amalgamation of a lot of people that we admire,
like,
you know?
Joan,
and there's some Phyllis Diller, because she has a mm-hmm. lot of like made up elements of her life in the beginning of her act, and
yeah.
You know, Rita Rutner, and like people that are like Vegas comics.
Did you go out there and like?
Well,
did you go
shooting? We did, and you know, Jen was married in a drive through chapel there, so Jen is kind of a Vegas girl.
Uh-huh.
Jen Statsky, my co-creator, loves it there.
Right? Do you?
I didn't before we started working there.
And now you
now
love Vegas?
Now I have an appreciation. I like it. Yeah.
An appreciation.
I mean, I wouldn't go there. I'm not going there for a bachelor party, you know, but...
No?
Well, no.
So what is the higher tier of Vegas? Because there's some part of me that I don't know how to have a good time in, you know, too many situations.
Yeah, I get that.
So
get
the
that.
Idea is like, you know, come up to the penthouse after the show and a lot of people are coming right by and, you know, that sort of like, you know, champagne and like the glitz of it all.
I don't know that either.
Uh-huh.
I've only been in production there. Truly, I've been there in production, and I went there once for a Monster Jam
show. What was that? Like, who was on that?
Oh, I don't even know. It was like, you know, Grave Digger. It was like Monster Trucks.
Oh, Monster
I went there,
Trucks.
I went there to shoot a sketch.
Oh, okay.
At, in Las Vegas.
It wasn't this guilty pleasure of
I've
yours.
Never been there for pleasure, to be honest. I mean, I try and have pleasure. You know, we have good meals when we're shooting there because there's great restaurants and there are great shows. We've seen great shows.
Like what?
I mean, you know, Adele's there now. You know, there are people that are really, you know, Adele. You two had their show there.
Yeah, that with the Sphere. So you were there. It was it was up and running.
It was up and running. Well, this season. This time it was up and running,
Did you go see you two there?
I didn't. But Lucia's aunt went twice. So I feel like I've gotten...
Your wife's aunt.
Yes, my wife's aunt her, went multiple times.
To
as a lot of people
too.
Have. Yeah, yeah. People
and love the... Who were the comics in residency there when you were there shooting? Were there any?
That's a good question. I mean, Carrot Top. Has never left. Carrot Top is still there.
We're at the Luxor.
Yeah.
I saw him there before. I interviewed him.
Oh, you did? Yeah. Okay. You know, he was on the show this year or last year, season two.
Yeah. I remember.
No, season three. God.
Season three.
They're blending together.
Yeah.
Even for me. But yeah, he was on.
So I don't like it's weird that your name, Paul Downs, it's triggering to me for a very weird reason.
Oh, no. Why? What happened?
Well, there was this booker, and I believe it was in Boston when I was starting out. There was a booker who booked the Comedy Connection. I think his name was Bill Downs, and his partner was Paul Barkley, and I didn't like them.
Oof. So, jeez, so, two for two.
What is Paul where Downs. Does the name Downs come from? What is it?
It's like English-Irish.
Oh, it is.
Yeah. My, but, you know, the Downs side of the family, I'm from New Jersey.
Yeah.
And they were, I think they landed in New Jersey whenever they landed and were there for a long time.
Revolutionary War time?
Well, so my grandfather, who was also Paul, my dad is Paul, my grandfather was Paul, I'm Paul, my son is Paul.
Really?
A lot of
Pauls.
That? Yeah, but we call him by his middle name, which is Luca. So he doesn't go by Paul.
Wait, so you just felt the pressure to...
Kind of.
You kind of need...
Kind
is,
of.
Is your dad still around?
He is. Yeah.
Oh, so you kind of...
Yeah. And we were like, you know, Luca is so Italian.
So he's Paul the Third?
We all have different middle names, so there's no first,
no
second,
first, second,
fourth.
Third?
No.
We didn't go the whole...
We're all originals, you know?
Where in New Jersey?
Well, I was born in Morristown, but I'm from a town called Sussex Borough, which is in, like, very northwestern Jersey. Very, very, very rural.
Oh, yeah.
Like, livestock auction every week.
Yeah, people don't realize that about Jersey. It's a very green, farmy state.
Oh, yeah. Where I'm from, I think it's, you know... I don't know, 1,200 people in the town. Really small.
But not close to New York, so you didn't have that.
No, like two hours from New York.
Or the beaches, so you're not
near the beaches.
You're not jerseyed.
No, not even near the turnpike. You know, people are like, what's your style? Our exit was, it took us an hour and a half to get to the turnpike, so.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you didn't have you don't identify Jersey.
I do, but I have a really different understanding
experience.
Of the state. People are like, oh, the Soprano, oh, Newark Airport, you know, people are like,
you know, hour from the city.
Yes. Yeah.
Not you.
I don't even have, you know, people are like, what's your mall? I think we were like 45 minutes from the Rockaway Mall.
Okay.
So, you know, there wasn't even a mall nearby.
A different Jersey experience.
Very different.
And you got a bunch of brothers and sisters?
I have a younger sister, Emily.
And that's it?
Yep.
Oh, that's good.
Just two of us.
And what's your dad? What was he?
So my dad was in procurement. He was a buyer.
Of what?
Well, he worked for a bunch of companies. I think for the longest time he worked for this company, a Japanese company called Sumora. Mm-hmm. And they licensed Disney brands and made like Little Mermaid shampoo.
Oh,
and like Beauty and the Beast kids toothbrushes. You know, it made
so
like
there was
all
a lot
kinds
of that around
stuff.
The house?
We did have a lot of that. We did have a lot. We had, whether it was potpourri or themed toothbrushes, we did have a lot of that.
Bring home the boxes of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he worked like really, he worked in the city.
Yeah.
So he drove like 2 hours
every
each way. Yes. And then when I went to public school, my mom is a public school teacher. I have two aunts and two uncles who were public school teachers. A lot of teachers in my family.
Yeah.
And then in about 6th grade, my parents were like, it's really small and rural here. We're going to take you out of the school and go somewhere else. And so I went to a school that was an hour and a half from my house. So
Every day?
I drove 3 hours a day
For high school?
Just before high school, 7th grade. 6th grade, I went to my school was 2 kids in 6th, 2 kids in 7th, 4 kids in 8th grade, all in
what
one class.
Fuck?
I know.
And they just wanted you to have a broader experience?
My mom was a sub. She substitute taught at the school one day and was like, I think you should have...
At your school?
Yeah. And I think she was like... Because even then, I wanted to act.
Yeah.
Right? And so she was like, I think...
In junior high?
We should look somewhere else.
Yeah.
Even younger. When I was
Isn't that
really...
a weird thing? I remember my mom substitute art teached at my school, and it was like such a big day.
Yeah.
Your mom's going to be.
Yeah, yeah.
Teaching was weird.
Yeah. My mom came in and did like presentations. My parents collect antiques, and they bought a the reason I lived there was they bought a really old house that was built in 1749.
Wow.
Way far the heck out.
Yeah.
And they have never moved. They still live there.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like their Bob Vila passion
so
project.
They did it
That's their weekend
life?
Warrior project. Yeah, they're still doing it.
Yeah.
You know, they just put an air conditioning upstairs this year.
Oh, they didn't want to ruin the old structure.
That's right. That's right. They kept
So they've spent a lifetime sure. getting this thing historically correct.
That's right. And it is very historically correct. But anyway, my mom would come in and do like they were really into history.
Yeah.
And my mom would do like presentations around what life was like in colonial New Jersey. So that was my experience of my mom coming to school and showing people how to churn butter. You know, it was like
did she have a churn?
Oh yeah. We had a butter churn. Yeah. We had a butter
Come
churn.
On.
We had I don't even
But was that a regular thing or was this an antique they had?
It was an antique.
Your mom didn't churn butter.
No. It was something that they had, but then they could bring in the prop.
Right.
You know, my
sure.
mom, you know.
Yeah.
Going back to Carrot Top, they could bring in the props.
Yeah,
you know,
butter and, churn. Yeah, yeah, maybe he'll hear this. And
yeah,
he'll.
I hope he does. He's got to bring more colonial stuff into his work. You know,
at this point, he probably needs it.
He may have it actually.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Oh my God, he's a character.
Yeah.
So that was your life.
Yeah, we didn't really have sleepovers because we couldn't run in the house. My parents were like, be careful.
Really?
Yeah.
Don't break anything.
Don't break things. Yeah.
Don't break yourself.
Both.
Was it like all hardwood floors, staircases, and the whole thing?
Yeah, wide plank, hardwood floors, you know. Small staircase, though, because it was, you know, 18th century, so low ceilings, low doorways.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Is it pretty?
It's really pretty.
Yeah.
People are always like, is it haunted, you know, because it's got
everything
that vibe.
To be haunted.
Everyone does want, everyone's like, tell us about the ghosts.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
It's like
yeah.
their first question.
Oh, it's that old, so it's got to be haunted.
Yeah. Many people died here,
yeah.
you know?
Everywhere.
Yeah.
Everywhere you go.
Everywhere.
That's the one thing you people don't consider. It's like whatever, if any house you've ever lived in is more than 50 years old,
yeah.
there's death in there.
That's right.
But do you believe in ghosts?
You know, there were some weird experiences we had, but I'm not like I'm certainly not a paranormal
investigator. Yeah, yeah.
No.
Weird experiences?
Well, you know, people were always like, is the house haunted? It's like, well, weirdly, like, toilets would flush on their own, which
no.
did seem strange. I know. But then again, you just chalk it up to old plumbing. But the attic light would often be on and no one had been up there. You know, there were things like that.
Oh, yeah?
But nothing like...
You didn't see anybody.
I was never touched by a ghost, you know? I was never molested by a ghost.
You never felt one brush by you on the staircase?
No. Knock wood. Actually.
So when did you start thinking that you needed to act?
You know, I wanted to do it when I was pretty young. My mom would take the train with me into the city and I would audition for like a, you know, detergent commercial.
Yeah.
Never booked. But I kind of always wanted to do it, but I think I got into comedy.
That's a weird sad ride home, isn't it? When you don't get the detergent commercial.
And you know, my mom would be like,
buy you
well,
ice
it's
cream.
Because you have perfect diction and they want children with lisps because yeah. children with lisps are cuter. You know, and so there was always a reason. And I was like, okay,
did
great.
Did you try to get the lisp going?
No, I didn't put things on. You know, I was just, I was purely myself.
Straight.
And they didn't want that.
Yeah,
they just
right.
didn't want it.
Yeah. Their loss.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I appreciate it. It was probably good. You know what? Who knows where I'd be? Maybe not here.
There's plenty of people that done commercials. They did all right.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
But I think actually it was probably when I started changing schools that I was like, I didn't really, you know, I didn't know the world of going to a private school. A lot of those kids had been in school together since they were in kindergarten.
Yeah.
You know, I was like odd. And I think that's.
Odd?
Yes. I was odd. I was kind of an eccentric kid.
Are you odd now?
Not less odd.
Yeah.
Yeah, I am less odd. I guess that's sad.
But maybe you
I'm
were.
I'm still odd. I'm still odd, but less eccentric.
But like if you were exactly the way you are now, then it would have been odd.
That would have been odd. Yeah, exactly. That would have been great, actually. I wish I had some of the wisdom I have now in seventh grade. But
well, how are you odd? You mean the other kids made fun of you?
I, like, made my own. Like, we had to wear, like, you know, there's a dress code, which I wasn't used to, and we had to wear a tie to school, and I would, like, make my own ties, you know, this kind of, like.
Make it?
Yeah.
You'd sew them?
I would, like, glue buttons on a tie, you know, and have, like, a tie with 1,000 buttons, you know? It was, like.
So you were odd in that you needed to be different.
I guess so. I also wore like patent leather wingtips. It was like, huh? It was very, I don't know why. I mean, my parents were very encouraging of letting me be
Express
my freaky
yourself.
Self. Yes.
Yeah.
And so They changed the dress code my second year of school. Because it used to be you had to wear a blazer and a tie, and then they were like, well, it has to be a navy blazer. It can't be red.
Yeah.
And it has to be like a, you know,
yeah,
a tie that doesn't have buttons all
over
it.
So you were pushing the envelope however you could within the context of the dress code.
That's very kind of you to say. That's very kind. But I was pushing the envelope and trying to edge up.
Well, you were.
Yeah, I guess.
You know, I remember there was that need to... Yeah, I had this memory the other day from high school where I went out with this girl on a date, and there was no reason for me to go out with her. She was, you know, kind of like, you know, big hair, you know, from waspy, country clubbish person.
Uh-huh.
But I had asked her out because I was ambitious.
Good for you.
And I remember showing up at her house to pick her up, and I'd worn, my dad was kind of a clothes hound, and he had this leather trench coat.
Wow.
It was a very kind of like a nice, shiny leather trench coat. So I put that on, and I had these orange Converse high tops.
Okay. We're cut from the same cloth, I'm hearing.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
And, you know, and I knocked on that door, and that girl's mother opened the door, and the look she gave me was just sort of like, I'm not pulling this off.
Wow.
I'm not, like,
wow.
She was like, what is my daughter, what is wrong with this kid?
That's cruel. That's a cruel parent.
Well, yeah, they're awful.
Yeah.
But I thought about it because occasionally I like to catalog my embarrassing moments, of which there are many.
Oh, isn't that fun? I have those too. Yeah.
It is my biggest fear in life is just that feeling of embarrassment.
Yeah. Me too.
It's the fucking, and then we're both in comedy.
And it's embarrassing.
But it's our way of owning it.
I guess. Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
I mean,
it's our banana peel.
Yeah. I mean, it's just sort of like if you can go do comedy of any kind, you know, when you fail, it's like the worst fucking possible thing. But because you've chosen this outlet, you've got to suck it up.
Right, right. So and it's you've like, done it to yourself.
Yes. Yeah. It's this on-the-job training to overcome embarrassment.
100%.
Oh, my God. Buttons on the tie.
Why I got into it, was to beat people to the punch, I guess, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, fuck you, I'll fuck me.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Oh, my God. It's reminding me of a joke that I do that does not work.
Oh, what is it?
I don't want to date myself.
Yeah.
But I would suck myself off.
Yeah, yeah.
And that never works. I always think it's going to work. I would suck myself off again.
Again.
Anyway, yeah, again. I added the again recently, but it still doesn't work. I don't know why.
Do you put a little space there?
Yeah, a little ellipses, yeah. I would suck myself off again.
Again, yeah. Yeah, you do that. Still no.
I have to repeat it. It's bizarre, but I'll try. I can keep trying. I'm committed to the joke. I do think it will work. You know, when you have a strong belief?
Yeah, dude, I've done jokes that don't work for the whole run.
Well, as long as you like it, I guess that's okay.
Well, it made me think of this thing, Fahim. You know Fahim?
No.
Fahim Anwar. He's
a comic. Oh, yeah, yeah.
I started following a bunch of people on Instagram because I was told I should by my Instagram guy.
Uh-huh. That's good. That's good.
I don't know which rock star it was that the myth about having someone who had removed ribs.
Oh, Marilyn Manson.
Right. So he could suck himself
off.
Oh,
yes. Yeah.
And Fahim's take on it was that, like, you know, how jaded do you have to get to where you don't even want to bother with the party or with the girl?
You go through surgery.
Right. Yeah. Like the angle was like, hey, you want to come? We got some girls coming. There's going to be a party. So, no, I'm good. I'm just going to go home. You know.
Yeah. Oh, God.
So how much stand-up do you do?
You know, I did a little bit when I first started out doing comedy in New York. And I quickly pivoted to doing stuff at the UCB.
But okay, so what's the jump? So you go through the, you know, you push the boundaries of fashion.
I absolutely rock seventh grade.
And then they changed the fashion code.
That's right.
Probably because of you.
The dress code was changed. So yes, what? I was shamed. No, not really, but
they made it stricter?
It was stricter. It was like you had to wear like brown leather shoes instead of just like leather tie-up shoes.
Oh, yeah.
I think the purpose in the beginning was no sneakers, and then it became also no patent leather wingtips. And then instead of, like, any color blazer, it was a navy blazer.
So they shut you down.
I guess. I guess I was censored early on.
And this was in high school? No.
It was the year, 2 years before high school.
And where'd you go to high school?
I went to a school called Pingree in central New Jersey.
Is that where you started acting?
Pretty much. I mean, I did take acting classes like extracurricularly, but yes.
They
had
a
great theater program. No, I did it like in Sussex County, you know.
With some lady?
With some lady who did like, you know, pantomime class, you know, and I got really good at like pulling an imaginary rope and being in a box, you know.
Okay, sure. Those are the classics.
Yeah.
Wind? Did you do wind?
A lot of wind. Oh, yeah. A lot of wind. A lot of fighting wind. You know, going down an elevator.
Sure.
That wasn't there. But then, the reason I chose this particular school, because there were other schools that I applied to. One, I got financial aid to go, but also it was a school that, it was pretty much a performance art high school.
Yeah.
So you like, you chose your discipline, whether that be music or, you know, visual art or theater. And then it was like what you did. You didn't take other art classes.
Right.
You just did those. And it was also a high school where there was sports and everything else, but there was a great theater program and they were doing like very adult. I think when I visited, they did Marat Saad and it was like very adult plays. The department led by Al Romano, got to give him a shout out.
Yeah.
There was a lot of like Reaganism stuff. There was a lot of like,
Can't do that anymore. I bet.
I don't know. Maybe not.
It's an interesting time, you know, because like, and I'm older than you obviously, but there was shit going like crazy art going on. You know, with young people.
Yeah.
That just, I bet, it's certainly not going to exist in a public school anymore.
Right. No way. Yeah.
Yeah. But I guess with a private performing arts school, they can still.
Maybe they
can. You would think there's
it.
No parents that are like, what's going on at the art school?
Yeah, right.
Where my kid is wearing this hat.
Although you never know. You never know who's going to be up in arms about
art side. Kids. I love when, like, I'd really kind of like to go watch a production of an adult play done by high school students. I don't think I've seen one as an adult.
I certainly haven't. It's probably good that we don't randomly go if we don't have.
I mean, when I was in junior high, we did like Meet Me in St. Louis.
Yeah, sure.
And
you did the classics.
Yeah, yeah. And I remember I had this, you know, this, you know, the mustache that turns into sideburns.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
All glued on, and there's some scene.
Oof, yeah.
Where, you know, I walk out and they throw water at me.
Uh-huh.
And one of them, like, the mustache stuck to the wall. And, like, again, embarrassing. But big laughs.
Yeah, I bet.
Big laughs.
Is that where you got the bug for laughs or no?
I don't know. I don't think so. I don't know where that happened.
So you were interested in acting before stand-up?
I think I was, yeah. Yeah. I mean, but I just didn't pursue it because, you know, I was doing stand-up, and acting was always part of it, but I just never could figure out. I took acting classes, but I didn't pursue it because I can't handle auditions. I couldn't then, you know, and I never had really good representation. And my representation was always, you know, someone doing a favor to my manager. Mm. And I'd go into these auditions and just blow it.
Yeah.
And then I'd walk in and I'd see actors I'd seen on television. I'm like, what am I even here for?
I know. My first year in LA, I was like, there are very famous people in this room.
Yeah, and people that are just better than me at this.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, whatever it is.
Yeah, and, well, you're a very good actor.
Well, I appreciate that.
And I'm not blowing smoke because I'm on your pod. Well, it's true.
I appreciate that. But you look at these jokes and there's a way to do that kind of acting.
Yeah.
And it was not what I had conceived of as what acting was.
Right.
Just delivering these mediocre jokes.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I just, it really, by the time I started stand-up, it was really, I rarely went out.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't really start acting until I did my show.
Right.
And then I had to learn how to do it in front of everybody. First season was a little embarrassing.
I don't think so.
Well.
It seemed very natural.
Yeah, I can't look at it.
I don't watch myself very much.
Yeah.
I mean, I do for Hacks because we edit the show, so I'm in the edit, but otherwise, not a lot.
Yeah, but like, you know, but you're very good at it.
Well, thank you.
And, you know, when I watch myself, what I see is like just these moments where I'm like, I wasn't in it, and I knew it that day, and I don't know why the fuck they use that. You know, that thing, what am I doing with my hand?
Yeah, oh, God. Okay. What to do with your hands? That's why you need business all the time, you know?
But I'm naturally a business. It's to the point where I'm like, I'm doing the business with my hands. I'm like, this character wouldn't do this.
Right, right.
And then you, in the middle of talking,
why are you crocheting? Yeah. What's...
Why did you just put his hands down abruptly? That was the moment he realized he was being himself.
Yeah, yeah.
But so you're at that high school and you're doing it?
Yeah, so I'm doing theater there. And it was actually the first place I started writing for myself. I wrote character monologues because there was at lunch you could go to the Black Box Theater and perform for students who wanted to do that. So I guess it was
People were just hanging around eating lunch in there?
Yeah, you could go and eat lunch and it was like a coffee shop vibes.
Oh, that's good.
Which was kind of good.
That's
good. I started writing for myself.
I like that idea.
It was great.
Why don't they have coffee shops like that now?
They should.
Well, I mean, I know they have open mics and shit or like little shows at coffee shops, but just a coffee shop where there's just a stage.
Right,
and,
where you could do that. Yeah.
But because people would be annoyed.
Yeah. I'm trying to get my pour over.
Especially in this town.
Yeah.
You know, where people are really delivering it.
Yeah.
All the frustration of not having a career comes out in these monologues at a coffee shop.
Oof.
That'd be hilarious. It's sort of a funny
sketch. It might be good.
Yeah. Maybe. I just don't know how many people on their way to work would put themselves through that.
Would wait online for their coffee. Yeah.
We just have this needy person.
Yeah.
What kind of monologues?
My first one was a Norwegian goat milk farmer.
So this is a comedy monologue?
It was a comedy. It was very much a comedy
Thank
monologue.
God.
Yeah, there was nothing serious about like, it. Yeah.
I really wanted to dig into this guy.
Yeah, no. It was really about his trauma. About his goats.
Yeah.
But so I started writing for myself there, and then I did Governor School when I was in high school, which is like a summer program for theater. And then when I was looking at colleges, I ended up going to Duke, but I saw their improv group when I visited, and I was like, oh, this would be a great, and there are plenty of schools that have improv groups or sketch groups, but sure. That was the only one that I was visiting that, not only did I see it, it was like in there. You know, their materials when they give you like the brochure for the school, they are also in it.
And so it's like a long-standing improv group.
Yeah. It was. Right. So I was like, okay, that sounds like the kind of thing I want to do.
Yeah.
Which is so insane to be like, I'm going to go to the school for the improv group. It's really wild. But.
Well, who the fuck knows what they want to go to school for? People in entertainment generally don't. You're just buying time because you can to figure it out.
Yeah.
I just had a realization that like, I think I've always been kind of a performer for the laughs. I just remembered that when I was in third grade, me and this kid Jerry used to go in front of the class and do Sesame Street sketches.
Yeah. You would just like recreate them.
Well, I'd be the straight man and he'd be Grover.
Yeah.
That was the whole shtick.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And oddly, that kid went on to do radio.
Wow.
In my hometown. It's cool. Very strange.
So, but was it originals or were you just...
I think it was originals.
Oh, that's cool.
I think that like I don't remember watching Sesame Street, but he did such a good Grover voice.
Yeah, yeah.
I could just, you know, set it up. Yeah. I wish I remember what it was.
Yeah.
Maybe I don't think about what really got me here as much as I should. But it seems like it's always been part of the thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the first time I was like, oh, I can be funny, was just like doing an impression of Robin Williams in Mrs. Doubtfire for people, you know, just doing lines from the movie and being like, oh, I can do this.
Yeah.
This is fun.
I think I did it in class. I got kicked out of a school for being disruptive. And I know it wasn't for angry disruption.
Right. Yeah.
It was just for hijacking the class.
Yep. Class clown stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Several teachers were like, I can't teach.
Yeah.
I forget about all this stuff.
I had that too.
You did?
Yeah.
They kicked me out of a school.
Wow.
They're
okay,
like,
I never went that far. I guess I wasn't that good a clown. They were able to rein it in.
Yeah, I got a teacher hit me in the head once.
Jeez.
For being a smartass.
Okay, yikes.
Yeah, I needed a lot of attention. Badly parented.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you're writing monologues.
Yes, yeah,
so
Goat
Farmer, that was a big one.
Goat Farmer, yeah. And then when I went to college, I did improv, and I was in a sketch group there.
And that was just, so you're writing sketches.
Yes, but I was never writing, you know, like a show for myself or a pilot. And I wasn't doing stand-up there either. And I kind of wish I had been writing more just for myself.
Well, that's a fucked up, not fucked up, but that's the great thing. Like, I can't really wrap my brain around the magic that it takes to make a show work as a writer. Mm. Because, you know, having done my show, like, I knew the shortcomings of whatever we were doing on Marin, and I knew that there were other shows that were inspired and brilliant, and you know, it was just never my life. I was always concerned with, you know, being authentically myself. But like your show, I mean, the characters are so defined, and you know, there's not really any false notes to it, and it's a pretty big world. And it's hard for me to even imagine how that comes together.
Well, we have a great writer's room with a lot of people that some of them have lived the experience of someone like Deborah, you know?
Deborah.
Jean Smart's character.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So like, you know, we have people like Carol Leifer and Janice Hirsch.
Oh, Leifer's in there?
She was in there for season 3.
Okay.
And we've also had consulting producers like Meryl Marco,
Oh, yeah.
Who consulted this year.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So we've had people who have certainly lived the experience.
Yeah.
You know, we have great stand-ups in the room.
Who's in there?
Joe Mandy.
Well, I know Joe. Yeah. He's on the show, too.
So funny. Yep. On the show as well. Yeah. Pat Regan.
Yeah.
Guy Branum.
Yeah.
Wrote on season three. So we, you know, we have people from, like, in our writer's room that bring so much to it. But also, I think, you know, we just, we were very carefully consider the characters and care
and the
about
casting.
Them. And, yeah, and the casting is a huge part of it. Huge part of it. Because to make that character be a believable stand-up, it needs to be performed like one. And that is really hard.
Yeah.
You know, because you see stand-up in film and television, and you can tell when it's like, this is an actor.
Yeah.
This is not, but, you know, Jean, when she read the script, said, yeah, I've always wanted to do stand-up. She said when I was, you know, and I maybe you'll have her on, so I don't want to spoil any of her stories, but she said when I was 12, for a Halloween party, all the girls were princesses and mermaids, and I was Phyllis Diller. I teased my hair, and people were like, who are you? None of the other girls knew who I was. But she's like, I always loved it. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of an amazing thing to do an original world, especially comedy, where it really kind of works. But, I mean, that makes sense with those writers. It's just, really a matter of the groupthink of the whole thing. And people, you know, checking, you know, when you have people that live the life who can go like, you know, this isn't authentic.
Mm-hmm.
I imagine that happens.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But all of us come from some comedy background. So whether it's being in a writer's room or, you know, having done improv and sketch, like we all know what it's like to be a comedian and to hang out in the halls of UCB and to what the love language is like for comedians, because whether you're a stand-up or, you know, you're somebody who's just done improv, I feel like it's not dissimilar. You know what the world is like.
Yeah.
And the show is very much about, you know, the different worlds of stand-up too, you know?
Totally.
So.
Yeah, all the way down to, you know, the world now.
Yeah.
Yeah. But okay, so you're doing the improv at Duke, you're getting confidence as a sketch writer,
mm-hmm.
getting laughs.
Yeah.
The improv group's popular.
You know, we did a big charity show. We did like a fundraiser show for pediatric cancer research, which helped us get the basketball team to do the show with us every year. So that made it pretty popular. I'm not going to say every show we
did
was popular,
but
that one was good. Yeah, and I tell you what, Shane Battier, who was the captain my freshman year, was really good at improv. You know what? And I tell you, if they're as good as they are at sports and being in front of a huge crowd, it's not surprising. They were very confident and good.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, oh, that's funny.
And they were in videos because we started to do, you know, more sketch videos. So they would do videos with us. And
so that was part of the thing. Is it wasn't quite the internet yet, but, you know, you do the videos to put where?
Great question. Nowhere. I mean, I honestly think, YouTube was like starting then.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, again, I don't want to date myself, but I would suck myself off.
Again.
I think we started to put them on truly like maybe my sophomore and junior year. But in the beginning, it was just, it lived on in the show.
Yeah.
You know, we played them during the show as we like changed
games. Right. It was part of the show.
Yeah.
Right, right.
But
interstitial stuff.
Right. But it wasn't like archived somewhere.
Right.
And now, you know, it was shortly after that, I feel like it was like maybe a year or two after that like Lonely Island started, and like people started getting their stuff out on YouTube, and YouTube was like became a
was starting to happen.
Yeah.
So when you graduated, you went right to New York.
Yep, moved to New York.
And then so the YouTube was happening.
YouTube was alive and well. Yes.
When you got to New York.
Yes.
So what was the process in New York?
So I started doing stand up, and I found it.
Where?
I did. There was a club on 14th Street that was new. That was brand new. My memory is so bad. This is actually scary.
On 14th?
14th and 9th.
Oh, comics?
Yes, comics. Yeah.
That was a very high-end operation.
Well, they had an open mic thing, but I had tech, which for them was like, what? At the time, it was very like, you have sound effects?
Well, that's interesting, because that was like it was right in the meatpacking district.
It was, yeah.
Yeah, it was like this, we're going to do it right.
Yeah.
And the stage, it was tiered and nice showroom.
Yeah.
They had good food
backstage,
nice dressing room. There was a nice restaurant up front.
Yeah.
They were overpaying everybody.
It was nice.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one of the nicer places I did.
Sure.
I remember. I also did I did stuff at UCB. They had a show.
The original one?
The one under Gristiti's on 20th,
Yeah, that's the second one. Not the one that used to be a porno theater?
No, no. The second one.
Yeah, sure.
So they had a variety show called School Night.
But so when you did stand up at comics, you were just doing the open mic, doing like 5 minutes?
Doing the open mic, yep. I did a bunch of open mics. I did stand up New York. I did Gotham. I did an open mic there.
Because you thought coming out of college, you know, that was an avenue.
Yeah, and I was also auditioning for things, and I continued to not.
But it wasn't your obsessive passion was not, you know, you didn't necessarily want to be a stand-up, did you?
No, I wanted to be Robin Williams, so I just wanted to do it all, you know?
Yeah.
I kind of wanted to do everything.
Yeah.
But I think primarily I was like, well, I hope all of these roads lead to doing comedy acting.
Right.
You know, being a performer that does a little bit of all of it,
right.
You know?
Yeah. What was your style as a stand-up? Outside of that one joke,
it was a little bit absurd. I would do like call and response stuff,
but no improv stuff.
I didn't do a lot of riffing. There wasn't a lot of improv.
Or characters.
I did do characters.
You did,
which at that particular moment didn't feel like a trend. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like depending on where I went, like when I would do School Night, which was this variety show at UCB, it was stand up and characters and songs and crazy stuff. So you could kind of do whatever, and it felt seamlessly. It felt appropriate for the
well. There's a generation of people like, and you're a part of it, I guess. In that, you know, stand up, despite the existence of sketch and everything else, is still like this very not insulated, but it's a very specific path.
Yes,
and there's a very specific social structure around it. And even once, you know, alt comedy kind of became this other stage with the Brooklyn Rooms and whatever.
Yeah,
you know, stand up is stand up.
Yes.
And it's limiting in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
But like, it seems that the people that found UCB were like, oh, well, this is, I can do anything here.
Right. Yeah, totally. And that was the thing. I think like some of the stuff I ended up doing at UCB, because I started to do, you know, one person shows at UCB, that could have been done potentially on a stand-up stage, but it just wasn't, especially for
not
those.
Not really.
Like, not for those 5 minute.
Yeah, 5 minute or even
sets,
15.
You know,
you'd have to like, you know, either you'd have to become a sellable headliner with a variety show or whatever the hell you were doing.
Right.
Or you'd have to get your own, do it in another space.
Right. And, you know, some spaces were, like, there was the Creek in the Cave was new.
Well, yeah, that was later,
That was a place that I felt like I could do stuff and felt more myself. And
like-minded people were
exactly
there.
Exactly. Like, what I considered my audience, because I was that audience, was there, so.
Right. And those places were popping up all over the place. Like, Rafifi's was still there.
Yeah. Yeah.
With Merman and those guys, they're a little older than you, but that was still there.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the, you know, Pianos.
Yeah, I never.
Down there had a show, I think John Benjamin and Todd Barry and maybe Cross had a show there. Like, so there was that. They would have been the old guard by the time you were coming up, probably.
Yeah.
The original alt comics were already aging out.
Yeah, yeah.
Closing their rooms down.
Wow.
Well, what was your one-man show? Was there singing?
I did a few. There was no singing. I appreciate that, though. Thank you. Thank you for thinking that I can sing.
I just didn't know what you were going to do for an hour.
No, I did. I did characters and absurd bits. And like I said, I did like call and response and crowd work stuff. And, you know, It was a lot. It was mostly character stuff, but I did videos. I had videos that were like interstitial as I changed wigs. You know?
And were those going up on the YouTube eventually?
They never went on YouTube, but I had my first show was the Paul Down Syndrome. And then I did another one. I can't even remember. Full Blown Downs was my second one.
So who's at UCB at this time?
You mean...
Like, who are the people that... Who's your class? Is there anybody that's...
Yeah, so Abby and Alana from Broad City are my class.
Mm-hmm.
Lucia Agnello, my partner and my wife, was my class.
Yeah, you met her there?
I did. Aubrey Plaza was on my Herald team, my first Herald team with me.
Uh-huh.
I feel like Zach Woods was a little bit before me because he started, I think he was in high school when he started.
Yeah.
So he was actually there earlier, but it was that generation of people.
Right.
And it was a time when, you know.
So after Aziz and Kroll.
Yeah, a little bit after. But like Amy Poehler was still doing ASCAT.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, and Seth Meyers was doing ASCAT. So like on Sunday night, you could see Tina and Amy like perform.
Yeah.
So it was still.
Dratch.
You know, Dratch. Yeah. 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 So it was still like there were still like the original UCB4 would still be doing stuff.
Teaching?
not teaching. They didn't teach anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, they would for like special one-offs.
Besser, you know? Matt, Ian, and
Amy. I took a Matt Besser one-off during like a Del Close Marathon weekend, you know.
He's intense.
Yeah. He was intense. Intense teacher.
Yeah.
And very intimidating. You know, he's one of the UCB4, and then you're in class. And you're like,
I always like, it's so funny because like I've known him forever in a way. And but when he was younger, he always felt angry to me.
Yeah.
I always read him as like, there's a lot of rage in there. And then years later, I met him and or hung out and we did an interview and he was okay.
Yeah.
But he always struck me as like, this guy, you know, as an angry guy, I'm like, he's one of us.
Yeah.
So he did a workshop?
So he did like one class for the marathon. So I did that.
And so you were there when Abby and Alana developed Broad City?
Yes. Basically, when we were there, you know, I had gotten onto a Herald team. Herald team being like the kind of, you know, it's one of the main stage shows that you like audition for and try and get on. I had actually auditioned with Abby, I think, multiple times.
Yeah.
And Abby and Alana hadn't gotten on a team, and Lucia hadn't gotten on a team either. So Lucia and I actually started doing stuff at the Magnet Theater, which had been opened by Armando Diaz. And they all started doing their own stuff.
Yeah.
Kind of like offshoot stuff. In fact, Lucia met Jen doing sketch videos with a group called Landline, which was happening sort of adjacent to UCB.
Yeah.
And so it was around that time that Lucia was also like, hey, you and I should do videos because, you know, if you do an improv show, cool.
Yeah.
100 people can see it.
Right.
But if we do videos and put them up,
yeah,
a lot more people are going to see what we do.
Right, right.
So we started writing original sketches and putting them online. And it was around that time that Abby and Alana were doing their Broad City web series, which Lucia ended up directing some of, and I was in the web series. So
that started as a web series.
Yeah. For, I think they did like, it's so funny to call it seasons. I think they did like 3 seasons of a web series. Yeah.
And you were part of that.
Yes. A little bit. You know, we were, like I said, we were contemporaries, all of us trying to do this stuff.
Right.
And I was more doing digital shorts with Lucia.
Yeah. And those were successful?
Yeah, they were pretty successful in that, you know, what is success on YouTube? Some of them went viral and were passed around because at that time it was like, you know, people were passing things around on Facebook or, you know, and
you would rack up the views. Beginning of that thing.
Yeah. And also weirdly, it was like at a time when Splitsider was a site that was like reviewing digital shorts. You know, and we'd be writing about stuff that you did. And it was around that time that then Above Average, which was Broadway Video's digital arm, started paying people to do sketches for their YouTube channel. And so we were paid by Above Average to do a sketch series. And so that was our first like paid job in comedy.
And what was that called?
It was called Pauly Lou Mixtape because Paul and Lucia, as the comedy nerds we are, did like a Desi Lou homage.
Yeah,
and so we called ourselves Pauly Lou and we started, you know, making sketches for their channel.
Who was running that operation?
Jen Danielson was running it.
For Broadway Video?
For Broadway Video.
Yeah.
And she had worked with Lauren and was at SNL forever.
Yeah.
And started doing that. We made a bunch of those and a lot of them were quite successful, which was great because that got us some attention for representation. And it also, I think, was the only tape we had when Broad City was picked up to a show because, you know, Amy Poehler kind of agreed to EP the show and it went to Comedy Central. And it was because of the stuff that we had been doing kind of sort of our parallel path to Abby and Alana, that they said, hey, would you guys write for the show? We know you're trying to sell your own show, but would you write for ours? And we were like, yeah.
Yeah.
And Lucia got to direct the pilot.
So that was sort of, I guess, the beginning of kind of a, what's the word I want? Self-generating content.
Yep.
That was being picked up by major outlets.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because the way in before was, you know, you got to pitch, you got to, you know, do all this stuff. But you were of that first wave of people where it's like, oh, we have 10 shows.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Exactly. Yeah. It was weirdly like a moment when web series or things that were happening online were getting people work, which it did feel new.
Yeah. Well, I think it was new.
Yeah.
And that enables you to go around the old school, you know, paying your dues as a writing assistant or in a writer's room or any of that.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, we were in our first writer's room, we were one of like five people in the writer's room for Broad City. And we had never written for TV.
Yeah.
So we all kind of figured it out together.
Right.
And it was a great training ground.
Yeah.
Like having stuff on Comedy Central was such a training ground for so many people. But for us in particular, it was like how we figured it out.
And there's always, there's like, as Comedy Central kept plugging along and got worse and worse, you know, anything that stood out, it was like, oh, it's, you know, we got a thing.
Yeah.
Because I can't even imagine or remember or what else would have been on Comedy Central at that time.
Workaholics was on.
Well, that was
it
big.
Was just after Key and Peele. It was around the time of Schumer.
Okay.
So it was like a lot of people were like, you know,
that was the,
getting
the
their
new
first
wave.
Thing.
Yeah. And that, but those were popular because it did go through a kind of fallow time at some point.
Yeah. And you know what's interesting? Kent Alterman, who took over and bought Broad City and all those other shows.
I know Kent.
Had done Strangers with Candy.
Yeah.
However many years before when he was at Comedy Central.
Yeah. He's been in there forever. He was there when I was like on Comedy Central before it was Comedy Central, I think. I've known Kent forever.
Yeah.
Like he was there at the beginning when Herzog and Eileen took over Comedy Central.
And I think he left for a while to direct.
Yeah, he did something.
Yeah.
I'd seen him around. Yeah. I've seen him around here and there.
Yeah.
But he was the guy.
He was the guy.
Yeah.
Who gave a lot of us our chance. And let Lucia direct a pilot for TV, having only ever done stuff on YouTube.
Well, good for Kent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are
you in touch with Kent Alterman?
Oh, yeah. We see him every now and again.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
He's doing all right?
I think so. Yeah.
I remember there was a period there, the last time I saw him, where he lost a lot of weight and he's being very healthy. And I can't remember why, but he looked good.
Yeah, I think for good reason.
Yeah.
You know, I think it was, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, there was an issue. Yeah. He was there when I was exiled from Comedy Central. And he finally told me the story.
Oh.
Yeah.
I don't even know the story.
Well, it was before you. It was like right when Eileen and Doug took over, they had left MTV to be the Comedy Central people. And I was doing some show at the Catch a Rising Star, and it was I didn't know, but it was most of that all the new Comedy Central people were in the audience.
Oh.
Almost like an office party or
something. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I just made one joke. I said, I'm glad that Eileen and Doug took over, left MTV to take over Comedy Central, because I think all television should look like a round-the-clock pie-eating contest. And apparently...
Yikes. Yeah.
This is like within the first week or two.
Oh, God.
And apparently they went on a corporate retreat.
Oh, no.
You know, and Herzog was like, no Marc Maron.
No.
On this, yeah, that joke.
Oh, God. Isn't that crazy?
It's
that something
crazy.
Like that can happen?
You realize that, you can say whatever you want.
Yeah.
But
there might be consequences. Totally. Yeah.
And I still love the joke.
Yeah, well.
It was pretty cutting.
They don't do originals anymore, so it is more like that now. Now it's no originals. That pipeline is gone.
Yeah, and this was before they even got started. But just the fact that I was a topic at the first corporate retreat of the new regime of Comedy Central.
Oy.
No Marc Maron.
That's so scary. That's the other reason that it's scary to do stand-up. I mean, there's a million reasons, but it's like, you're out there, you say something, and then you never know, you know.
Kent finally told me that. And I don't think Herzog is, you know, ever quite, well, who cares?
Yeah, yeah, it's okay. Yeah.
And like I've seen Doug Herzog maybe three or four times over the last, you know, 3 decades. And I still know, like in my heart, I'm like, there's some part of me that's like, yeah, I did that.
Yeah.
Like there's no shame in it.
No.
Just, and
speaking
I don't.
Truth to power.
Right.
Yeah.
But I don't know if it would be the same if I hadn't made it in some way.
Right, right, right.
Like if I was just some like nothing.
Right.
You know, just kind of chugging away as a stand-up, I'd probably see Herzog and be like, hey man, so.
Yeah, it would probably be different.
Well, the funny thing is all these guys, even guys in that power, they end up with a podcast. And I know that I think Doug did a podcast. I'm like, all right. So
did he? I didn't know that.
Oh. Yeah. And he said some shit about me, so I'll never have him on my button. No,
okay, blacklist.
I'm kidding. He's out. No, no Doug Herzog on WTF. So Broad City, did you act on it too?
I did. I played Trey Pucker.
That's right.
The trainer at Solstice, the gym.
Oh, yeah.
And Abby had handed out flyers for Equinox so she could get a membership. So that was kind of, and I went to Equinox. We both did. And so that was kind of based on, everything on this show was based on something.
I like Equinox.
That happened to one of us. Yeah, it was nice.
I'm going
it was
to
good.
Equinox.
It was good.
Like, I'm shooting in Vancouver, and there's one right down the street, and it was, like, the greatest thing ever.
I mean, it's in that way, it's worth it.
Yeah.
I don't belong anymore.
Why? What did you do?
You know, I did resign around the time that, like, their CEO had been donating to Trump. But I also...
I didn't even know that.
I don't know. I also... Yeah. It was just... It became a hassle to go, so...
What do you do for exercise?
I have, like, a Craigslist purchased multi-use thing at my house. Uh-huh. And then I go to this place, shout out to Ultra Body Fitness and Patrick McGran. I go there all like, right. You know, once or twice a week. That's my fitness routine.
So after Broad City, what happens? You're a player?
Yeah. We were on Broad City. Lucia and I wrote, and both of us directed on the show, and I was on the show, and we did it for all five seasons. So it took up a lot of our time. And then when we...
But what an education, right?
I mean, an amazing education, because we did it all. And it was very much like what we had done making YouTube videos, because, you know, I used to, like, hold the boom mic, and Lucia was in half of them. I would direct them. Or I was in half of them. She would direct them. So and we taught ourselves how to edit. We taught ourselves how to color correct. We were just doing all of it. And it was such...
So by the end of Broad City, you're, you know, an experienced showrunner.
Yes. I mean, Abby and Alana were showrunning, but we certainly understood what that meant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
On a manageable level.
Yes.
With reasonable risk factor.
Oh, yeah.
Like, in the sense that, like, you're not carrying some network juggernaut.
That was the best part, was that it was, because of what Comedy Central offered people like that, it was sort of a low-risk situation.
Right.
I think we didn't even get many notes season one because people were like, let's try it out.
Yeah.
They could take risks on comedy that they don't do anymore.
Right.
Because now it's like, well, it better generate subscribers because it's such a huge hit, or we can't do it.
Right.
So it is, I think, a big, big crisis right now.
Yeah.
In comedy.
Yeah.
There's just not a place that's low risk and you can cut your teeth and figure out your voice
except
and find
TikTok
your audience.
And YouTube.
Well, yes, that is the one place you can do it.
You can do it
on Instagram or on TikTok.
But you're saying that there's not a lot of, you know, interesting new comedy voices being engaged on the major streamers or network television.
That's the thing. I think it is all self-generated stuff. I think it's. I mean, I think to a
and
certain
a lot of
degree,
it's bad.
Yeah.
Well, that's an interesting idea because even when for some reason, Maria Bamford just came to mind with her Miss Dynamite. Is that what it's called?
Lady Dynamite.
Lady Dynamite.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which was, you know, she's a genius.
She is.
You know, but where are you going to make that now?
Yeah.
I don't even know where it was.
That's the thing. I don't know. It was on Netflix. I don't know if they would do it now.
Now, no.
And, you know, when I moved to L.A., and we actually moved to L.A. like the year Broad City was picked up. So we moved to L.A. and then started shooting a show in New York. So we went back for half the year.
Yeah.
But when I moved to L.A., I was like, you know what? I'm in a new city. I'm going to try stand-up again.
Right.
Because I really did love it, but I never really found my footing. And it was kind of lonely. And
yeah.
I enjoyed the collaborative process of
yeah.
doing sketch and improv and, you know,
yeah, sure.
having people like Jen and Lucia to work
yeah.
with.
Yeah.
So I'm starting to do open mics in L.A. I'm having a little bit more fun than I did the first go-round. And then I do a 4:30 open mic at a coffee shop in West Hollywood.
Yeah.
And Maria walks in.
Yeah. That's her prime time.
Well, I stopped. I was like, the dedication it takes to work that muscle, I was like, I can't. She had Lady Dynamite at the time. I'm like, you have a show on Netflix. How do you even have the energy, if you're the lead of this show, to do an open mic?
Well, she's a unique thing. I mean, you won't want to judge yourself against.
I know,
Maria's
I know. I now
process.
Know more about her, so I'm like, you know, I probably shouldn't have been scared off, but I was like, oh my
she's
god,
she's the person that gets people on her social medias to sit there and run her act in front of.
Right. I know. Now I know more. But at the time, I was like, oh my god.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that phase didn't last too long.
Yeah, yeah.
Of doing stand-up again in L.A.
So, but how does it unfold with, like, so Statsky is writing on Broad City as well?
She was. She was writing on Broad City between seasons of Parks and Rec and then The Good Place.
Oh, that's right. She did all that.
Yeah. So she came up sort of in a more traditional writer's room scenario. You know, she was, she worked at Fallon, and then she was on a bunch of shows and really worked her way up the writer's room ladder.
Right. So she knew real network television.
Yes. Yes.
So how do you know, where does the idea come for Hacks?
We were going from Boston. Both Jen and Lucia are from Massachusetts. And
where
we were going.
Where's your wife from in Massachusetts?
She's from Western Mass. She's from Hadley.
Oh, yeah.
Which is right near Amherst.
Yeah.
So she grew up in the Amherst
Hadley.
Area. Yeah.
Yeah.
Another, weirdly, a lot like my hometown. Like
yeah.
Like a rural, like, tobacco farms, weirdly.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah, Hadley? There's like tobacco and asparagus.
Wow.
Yeah.
And was her family in farming?
No, they were in the restaurant business. Her dad owned an Italian restaurant. She was born in Italy. And she came here when she was one. Her dad is Italian. Her mom's Italian too, but born in Boston.
Yeah.
And yeah, they had a pizzeria and then an Italian restaurant in Amherst.
No shit.
Yeah, a couple actually.
For the kids? Was it popular with the students?
I think that's why they moved, because he initially worked in Boston, and I think he moved with his partner in the pizzeria to Amherst because he was like a lot of college kids.
Yeah.
You know?
Eat pizza.
A lot of
keep
delivery.
It up and
yeah.
late. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think it did very well, and then they opened a restaurant.
Boston Italians are no fucking around. That's
no.
real shit.
Oh, they're real Italian. And he's real.
Yeah.
You know?
And is he a good cook?
Amazing cook.
Yeah.
It's almost like too good. It's like, don't visit too long, because you're going to gain 9 pounds. You know, it's like, he's an amazing cook.
And is your wife good?
Oh, yeah.
With the Italian shit?
Yes. Her and her brother and sister, both, they all inherited the gene. They're really good cooks. Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah.
Okay, so Boston.
Yeah, so we were driving to Boston because I was shooting a scene for my Netflix special, The Characters, which was a sketch special.
Well, you've done quite a bit of acting here and there, no?
Yeah.
I mean, that worked out for you.
It did.
Was that mostly from the Broad City? Was that your real-ish?
That was probably my first like big recurring part, yeah. And I had done other things, you know, I had done other parts on other shows, but that was my first big job. And then the character special, I got to kind of do my one-person show a little bit.
From the old days, did you do the goat farmer?
No. But I did, you know, I used to do a bit where I would come out as a visually impaired person on a Segway.
Uh-huh.
And I would just tap around with a cane on the stage on a Segway. That was the bit.
Yeah.
And I got to kind of turn that into more of a sketch. But we were driving to Portland, Maine to a Monster Jam, Monster Truck Rally, and I brought Lucia and Jen because they are the funniest people I know.
Yeah.
And they always make me funnier.
It was for a bit.
I was like, can you guys come and help write some jokes? Because I was kind of doing a little bit of a Sacha Baron Cohen thing where I was going in character to an actual show.
Right.
And they were going to give me the mic.
Yeah.
Because I emailed them and I was like, hey, I'm this enthusiast. Can I come?
Yeah.
So it was kind of scary, but also because it was improvised, I did need some help punching it up. So they both came. And it was on that drive we were talking about, you know, stand-ups, in particular, you know, female stand-ups, who we didn't feel like had ever gotten the due that their male counterparts had.
Yeah.
And we were also talking a lot about, you know, the kinds of like cool comedy, you know, what is, and it's not even cool comedy. I guess more of like the territorialism that exists in comedy.
Yeah.
Because when I was first doing stand-up, like I said, it was like, I felt like it was much more, they were like, you have sound cues? It didn't feel like it was...
Right.
I felt more comfortable in, like, the alt scene.
Sure.
Which wasn't brand new. I feel like in San Francisco, there was, like, riff culture in the 70s and 80s, and there was, like, weirder clubs.
Yeah, I was there
clubs.
For a couple of years, yeah.
You know.
They weren't weirder clubs, but there was something about... Because I went there after New York for 2 years, and there's something about just the nature of that city in terms of what it's always been defined by creatively.
Right.
You know, and at the core of it... There was definitely riff culture, but there was also just straight stand-ups. But the audiences, you know, New York, you got to punch your way out of a goddamn, you know, metal bag.
Yeah.
But there, like, they were kind of like, what is going to happen?
Right.
You know, there was a different tone.
Right.
Yeah.
So we were just talking about, like, the different and how, depending on what tone you were in and what group, what your scene was, the way there was... judgment sometimes for other scenes, you know, what was cool comedy, and particularly how that existed between generations. How, like, sometimes you'd see a stand-up on a late-night show as a young person coming up at UCB and be like, that person's funny? You know what I mean? You're like...
No, totally. Like, yeah, because, like, there was something about just the context of traditional stand-up that was stuck in time.
Right.
Like, you know, you even go into some clubs and you're like, what the fuck is this decor?
Right.
Is this 1983?
Yeah.
And it's still like that.
Yep.
I mean, if you totally. See posters for guys who play casinos, billboards, like when I'm in New Mexico or something, you know, and you're like, you know, Titus is playing at the you know, I'm like, oh my God, it never changes.
Yeah. Especially in a place like a casino.
Right. It's just stuck in this time. And there's something just innately lowbrow and kind of not working class, but just kind of there is this standard of road comedy that never went away.
Yeah, right.
And it's comedy club culture.
Yep. Yeah.
Old school.
Yeah.
So you're thinking about all
this
stuff.
We're talking about that. And, you know, the first time I ever saw stand-up was Paula Poundstone. She was the first stand-up I ever saw because I used to watch Comedy Central had Premium Blend or Premium Roast.
Premium Blend, yeah. Know,
they would do, like, little snippets of, like, Janine Garofalo's set or, like, Paula Poundstone.
Well, yeah, before that it was Short Attention Span Theater, which I hosted.
Yes,
And Stand-Up, which Keitlinger hosted.
Yes.
But you would have been
I was really young, but I used to watch it.
Right.
And not get it. But I wanted to be in on the joke.
Yeah.
I wanted to get it.
Yeah.
And you would see like Keitlinger and you'd see Garofalo and you see a lot of these female stand-ups.
Yeah.
And then, you know, men who were doing it at the time, often you knew them. You know what I mean?
Sure.
But unless you were a comedy nerd who was watching and trying to get in on the joke, you might not know Paula Poundstone.
Sure.
So we were just talking about how that felt not fair.
Yeah.
And also it was around the time that, you know, I feel like that piece of work documentary come out about Joan and how some people, you know, a younger generation didn't even know she was a stand-up. We're like, oh, doesn't she do like fashion commentary on red carpets?
Right.
You know, like didn't know her history.
Sure.
In terms
of
stand-up.
Knows history anymore.
I know.
Yeah.
So we were just talking about how it would be cool to explore that through these two generations of a younger comedian or younger comedy writer and this sort of like old school Vegas stand-up comedian.
Mm-hmm.
And we sent each other an email, as we often did when we had an idea for something.
Yeah.
And that was in 2015. And then we just didn't stop talking about it. We kept, anytime we'd have dinner, we get together, or we would be up at night and be like emailing each other, you know what's a funny scene? Or you know what'd be a great episode? Going back to her alma mater, you know, or whatever. And so we just did that for like 5 years while we finished Broad City and while Jen finished The Good Place. And then once both of those shows had their finales.
Yeah.
We said, okay, now's a moment we could pitch it.
And at that point of the pitch, like how many of the characters were in place in your mind? Because, you know, the whole sort of like the guy who plays her, you know, her business, the other businesses, the brand management guy.
Yes, her CEO.
Right.
Yes, Marcus.
And then the casino owner.
Yep.
What's that actor's name?
Chris McDonald. Christopher McDonald.
I'll never forget him in Thelma and Louise.
He's amazing.
It's
and what a career. I mean, he's so good.
Yeah.
And really funny.
Yeah.
He's really, really good.
That role in Thelma and Louise, like, I can never forget it.
It's amazing.
It's amazing.
I watched it recently.
It holds up, right?
My God, yes.
Just this...
So much.
Control freak, weird man guy.
Yeah. And I mean, he's in, you know, obviously he's Shooter McGavin. But he's also in Requiem for a Dream. I mean, the man's career is really, he is an underrated actor.
Real character actor.
Yes.
Excellent. And then, okay, so, and then, like, when did you decide to put your character's side of the business in it? Was it always there from the beginning?
It was from the beginning. We knew we needed to connect these two women, and we knew, we thought the manager would be that person. And we knew someone my age would represent someone like Ava, you know, who's like a young comedy writer.
Yeah.
But we were like, well, how can we get, and then we realized, well, maybe he is a, you know, His father was a big-time manager, and he inherited her as a client. So my character was in there from the very beginning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Megan Stalter's character?
Also in there from the beginning, not to the degree to which she became a part of the show, but she was always a part of it. We always wanted we are really interested in duos, you know, like classic, you know, straight man character duos.
Sure.
And so we knew that was a good opportunity for a fun duo.
Was she always the idea, or was that just casting?
So it was based on someone that we kind of knew in life, but then Meg started to do videos on Instagram.
Yeah.
And part of her shtick was being like super self-confident and having bravado, but also being like a little bit stuttery and sometimes also, you know, like second-guessing. And it was this great dichotomy that we really thought worked for the person that we were thinking about.
So
we did think of her for it.
And then you knew her from her videos.
From her videos, but I had been on a stand-up show with her, and seeing her live, I was like, this girl's special.
Yeah.
She's really, really special. So she auditioned for it, but there was no question.
That's very funny. It's a very funny pairing.
Thank you. We have a lot of fun. We have a lot of fun.
So you go pitch it to...
Yeah, we pitch it all around.
Who said no?
You want to know? Showtime said no.
Yeah.
Apple said no.
Yeah.
Amazon said no.
Yeah.
Hulu said yes. HBO said yes. And HBO Max was just launching, and they said yes. And I think that's it.
Was it Nina?
No.
At HBO?
That bought it?
Yeah.
It was Susanna Makos at HBO Max, and it was Amy Gravitt at HBO.
Oh, Amy, yeah, sure.
Yeah. But because they were launching the streamer,
yeah,
they weren't going to compete, and it sort of felt like, oh, well, the streamer does need content. This feels right, so it's going to go to the streamer.
And that's what it's on now?
Yeah, it's on HBO Max, or now Max.
Max.
Yes.
But, like, what is the separation now? I mean, is it on HBO as well?
You know, they have played an episode or two from each season on linear HBO, but no, it's only on Max.
So the difference is HBO proper is still linear.
Yes. And HBO proper, all HBO proper shows are on Max.
Max
shows aren't on the channel.
Well, so that was sort of an interesting victory for you.
It was great. Yeah, it was great.
That you popped their streamer.
We were one of the first ones, yeah.
And it took.
Yeah.
It's interesting that they don't run it in full on HBO.
I think it's like a whole different contract and a different thing. You know, I don't know.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's been great because I feel like so many people stream now, you know?
Sure.
It's found its audience.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
So, and then you got kind of sidelined by COVID.
Well, you know, we sold it before COVID.
Yeah.
And then we attached Jean before COVID.
Yeah.
Because we sent her the script.
Yeah.
She responded to it.
Yeah.
Thank God she said yes. And then we were casting the Ava part.
How'd you find Hannah?
She did a pre-read for our casting directors. So we saw a tape and we were like, who is this?
Yeah.
Had never seen her before. She had done a set on Colbert.
Yeah.
So that was the only thing we could find.
As a stand-up. Yeah.
As a stand-up. But she was really unique and really good.
Yeah.
And we auditioned a lot of people. A lot of great actors read for it.
Yeah.
And then during COVID, they said, why don't you just write the season? So we wrote the season.
So you got the deal, yeah. Right, and to write all, what, 10?
All 10.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'd written the pilot, so we had 9 left, yeah.
So that was almost fortuitous.
In a way, it was.
Yeah.
And then we screen tested Hannah and Jean together during COVID before vaccines on an empty soundstage with a sheet of plexiglass between them. And they were like 6 feet apart. So for someone like Hannah, who's never been on TV.
Yeah.
Never had a callback.
Yeah.
To go into this like empty soundstage with Jean.
Yeah.
Must have been so terrifying, but she was so good. She was so good. And our casting director said to us, there's one point at which in the pilot, Deborah says, oh, you're a fan of mine? What's your favorite joke? And Hannah blushes. In the audition, she blushes. And our casting director was like, she just blushed. She just blushed. I mean, it's crazy, her like physiological gift. She's a really good actor. She's a great stand-up.
Yeah. No, I love her.
But she's an amazing actor.
Yeah. So do you have that video of the plexiglass?
I think we do. Somewhere.
So crazy.
Yeah.
There's a few crazy things about that. Because I had when I started interviewing people in here again, through, I figured out how to do it on Zoom, but not on Zoom, but on another platform, which I hated.
Right.
I don't like not doing it in person.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was still, COVID was around, but people were doing things. And I had a plexiglass thing here. But it would have done nothing.
I know. We didn't know. We were washing our vegetables. You know, it was a weird time.
Crazy time.
Yeah, really weird.
Just going to the fucking supermarket. Freaking
out. Going. I like Instacart.
Putting on fucking gloves. I never did any Instacarts. And I never never ordered food. And I never did stand-up on Zoom. I never did outdoor stand-up.
I did one. I did an Instagram live stand-up.
Uh-uh.
And one Zoom. And then I was like, that's the only one. Talk about weird. No one's you can't hear any laughter. It was so weird.
I just couldn't do it. You know, and I mean, obviously I was dealing with the tragedy of Lynn's loss.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Thanks. But after that was still like, I was just holed up here, but I didn't feel compelled to, to do stand. I started doing Instagram lives.
Yeah.
Which was good and bad.
Yeah.
Because a lot of lonely people kind of latched on I had to stop.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because like that whole sort of parasocial relationship thing, is that what it's called?
Yeah.
Where, when people are holed up and you're on doing Instagram Live, I mean, something breaks in their brain and they're like, I'm going to FaceTime with Mark now.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
bizarre.
But it did keep me engaged in some sort of dialogue to generate thoughts publicly.
Yes. Yes.
And that worked. But yeah, what a weird fucked up time. So you shot, COVID was still there, but
oh, yeah.
They did, built the protocols.
Yes. So we wore like two masks and a shield. We, you know, oh it was like the protocols were crazy. And,
we're
but
all
also,
in PTSD because you like, know. Even just talking about it.
Yeah.
Like the zones.
Yep. Yeah. The AB. Yes. The zones. I mean, and Gene, you know, was like around 70 and diabetic. Yeah. So we were like, well, she's a national treasure. We got to be careful because she can't get COVID.
It's very interesting because I shot two Leslie in peak COVID. And the only time we weren't masked was when we were doing a scene.
Yeah, I know.
So it became very, like, there's an immediacy to it because there's this desperate need mm-hmm. for engagement.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It does heighten the thing a little bit.
100%.
You know, just like masks off.
You're
action.
Very alive, yeah. And you're like, let's get it done just in case somebody has COVID.
Did anyone get COVID?
There were people that got COVID, but nobody, no, I don't think any actors.
And you were
did.
Testing every 3 days on set?
Every day.
Every day.
Every day we rapid tested. Yeah.
God,
it was wild. My like brain was mush because they put that thing up your nose. You know, it's like, I had like calluses in my nose.
So that was the first season?
Yeah. Yep.
And then I'm trying to remember, when was that long wait between seasons?
Well, so season two came out basically a year after. So we turned that around really quickly. And then season three, we had, Gene had a cardiac issue and surgery. And then we had the two strikes. So
oh,
it became like
it.
A
right,
huge,
right, right. That was
huge
it.
Wait. We would have been finished
so
pre-strike.
So you survived COVID, and then the strike happened, and that fucked the timing up on the third season.
And then we took a long hiatus.
And now now this season was great. What a great ending.
Thank you. We
did you know that going in?
We knew that going into writing season three. We didn't know that like the day we pitched it. We knew that season three would be about the quest to get this chair, the quest for late night. But we knew that Ava would become her head writer. But we didn't know she would take it
like
until
that.
The first week of season three. But we did know it very, very early on in the writing.
And now how's the next season shaping up?
We're in the middle of writing season four.
Really?
Yeah. Which is crazy. But it's great. I mean, we left on such a propulsive note. It's been fun to play the dynamic. But uh-huh. there's a lot to also wrap your arms around.
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, we're writing about late night. And we're writing about the state of comedy and the state of technology.
Uh-huh.
So there's a lot that we want to say in the season. And so that's, you know, it's a tricky house of cards.
So now, but now you're effectively a producer of the new late night show,
right.
Who's at odds with Gene a bit.
Well, I'm at odds. Well, I don't want to give too much away, but you know.
Yeah.
Things are fraught.
Right.
Things are fraught. Yeah.
Yeah. So now, like, Gene's on the defensive.
Yes. And also.
But has to do the job.
I now have no longer an assistant. I have a partner in Kayla. So that's a whole new dynamic. There's a lot of new dynamics at play, which is fun.
And Hannah's got to be a hard ass.
Yeah, she's a dom. You know?
Yeah.
Evil Ava. Yeah.
Big shift.
Yep.
So we get to see all of her, you know, hidden power hungry.
That's right. She's got that fuck ass bob. You know, she's coming in with that short haircut.
And, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
so it's
gonna
fun.
Be good.
Yeah. It's fun. And I think it's fun for everybody to have a new gear.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I mean, that's what's amazing about the show is that you were like the return to stand up and then, you know, then this thing, the shift for the late night thing. And now, like, you know, I didn't know how that was going to go at the end of the season. How are you going to, you know, what do you do now?
Yeah.
And she gets the gig and then the power dynamic shifts. And then it's like how it must be a thrill going into the fourth season to really like, we got a whole new game here.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's not, we're not faking it.
Yeah.
You know, this we haven't jumped any sharks. There's no, we're not riding on, you know.
Blackwood, yeah.
Right? There's, we're not repeating ourselves.
No. It is all new. It's all new. And that's the thing that's been the challenge, but also the fun is that we try to blow up the relationship every season.
Yeah.
And yet also reset the dynamic because the grist between them, you know, that friction is where the comedy is.
Yeah.
Where the fun is.
Yeah.
So, you know, they can't just be in perfect harmony and yet we want them together. And so this season, being able to handcuff them together at a time and now create sort of the biggest friction between them is proving fun.
Yeah.
You know.
It's got to be exciting to write. And who's in the room? Same people?
Yeah, mostly all the same people. We did promote Carolyn Lipka, who was our writer's assistant last year. She's a staff writer this year, which is great.
That's great.
Have the guy.
And then you've got all these Emmy nominations.
Yeah.
Who are you up against?
We're up against Abbott Elementary and The Bear and Only Murders in the Building.
Oh, my God.
And I should know them all, but...
And so that's like now the sort of publicity machine is just going to take over.
Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. But, you know, we're in the writer's room, so it's like...
See,
you know,
it's not... I mean, that's what's
the
done
The focus
is
the room, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. And is everyone out doing press or what?
We do occasionally do, you know, a panel or a thing, but yeah, the room takes up most of the time.
Huh.
Yeah.
Gotta get Jean in here.
Definitely. You'd have fun with her.
I know. I don't.
She's
you know,
fun.
Look, I don't know. I know she doesn't do this stuff much, but she should.
I'll tell her.
Will you?
I will. We all do that. We always advocate when we think something is she would enjoy.
Because you know? She just doesn't like doing things?
No, like I said, she loves to work. She's just so busy working, you know?
But
and she also has a 13-year-old kid, and she's, you know, she's okay. She just moved. There's a lot.
She's done Kimmel and everything?
She's always busy. You know what? She just did Colbert.
Okay.
She does Seth a lot.
Yeah.
I don't know if she's done Kimmel.
Hmm.
I don't know.
Fallon?
I don't know that she's done Fallon.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, but I don't know, you know, I don't know if that's...
All right.
By design or what?
Well, it was good talking to you.
Great to talk to you.
I'm excited about the fourth season.
Thank you.
I hope you win the prizes.
That's very nice. Thanks.
Okay. Great guy. Smart guy. Funny guy. Just what an amazing achievement to write an original comedy series that is surprising and honest. I don't know how they do it, but I know a little more now. Paul is Emmy nominated for Outstanding Supporting Actor in a Comedy Series and Outstanding Writing for a Comedy Series. So hope you enjoyed that. Hang out for a minute. Hey, Full Marin listeners have another trip down memory lane to check out this week. We posted some segments from my radio show, Morning Sedition, including talks with my mom and Ben Folds.
Yeah, I wrote a song with... Nick Hornby, the guy that wrote High Fidelity and Bad Boy and all those things, and he just kind of cooked up out of his head this really cool story that happens to be really pretty close to Shatner's life without even knowing it. So it was, things came together in a really cool way. It was really, really neat.
Somehow you just cooked up a story about a Jewish guy from Canada who became a Starfleet commander?
Yeah, it's just like he had no idea. Because he's like the Nostradamus.
I guess so. Well, what was it about Shatner? Was this done with a campy sensibility or some sort of honest respect for his musical talents? Or is there a difference for you?
I think it was honest respect for his life experience and his acting talent. Mm-hmm. He's a really talented cat.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, I think you can take that for granted with someone, who's, you know, kind of been a thing in the business for that long, you know, and he's amazing. And it's a good record, but it's got some funny stuff. I mean, he's funny, like, and he can't help that. So that's in it, but it's also serious as well.
To subscribe to The Full Marin and get bonus episodes twice a week, as well as every episode of WTF ad-free, go to the link in the episode description or go to WTFpod.com and click on WTF Plus. And a reminder before we go, this podcast is hosted by Acast. Here's some sludgy guitar that I kind of fucked up towards the end, but, you know, that's just the honesty of it, man. We'll be right back.
Shatner lives. Monkey LaFonda, cat angels everywhere. That one got away from me a little bit. It's all right.